Welcome to the Deep Dive, where we filter the noise, dig into the sources, and pull out what you really need to know. Today, we're taking a deep look at a story that's, it's foundational for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. We're talking about the testimony of the eight witnesses to the Book of Mormon.
Yeah, and our mission here is pretty straightforward. We're going to unpack the source material, you know, letters, histories, that kind of thing, to really understand what these eight men said they saw. But maybe more importantly, we need to look at why their claims, which were meant to be this solid physical proof, often get, well, even more scrutiny than the spiritual claims.
Okay, so let's set the stage right away.
Yeah.
When we talk about the gold plates, there are always two groups of witnesses that come up. We've already covered the three witnesses. That's Oliver Cowdery, David Whitmer, and Martin Harris. Their story was, deeply spiritual.
Hmm.
An angel, a voice from heaven.
Exactly. And that distinction is just, it's everything here. Even the early church historians knew the two accounts had very different jobs. B.H. Roberts, who is a huge figure in church history, drew a really sharp line. He said the three witnesses had a splendid display of glory and power of God. It was all supernatural.
So if the three are all about faith and this, sublime power.
Yeah.
What was the point of the eight witnesses?
Well, Robert said their experience was a plain matter-of-fact exhibition of the plates by the prophet to his friends. And this is the key part. It was attended by no supernatural display. The eight were supposed to be the physical, tangible, objective evidence, proof that these plates were real three-dimensional objects.
Right. If that's the goal, objective, physical proof, you'd expect the eight people to be, unbiased.
Yeah.
But when you look at who was actually in this group, that word objective gets... Well, it gets really complicated fast.
Oh, absolutely. When we just list the names, the insularity is, it's kind of shocking. You have Christian Whitmer, Jacob Whitmer, Peter Whitmer Jr., and John Whitmer, then Hiram Page. And then three members of Joseph Smith's own family, Joseph Smith Sr., Hiram Smith, and Samuel H. Smith.
So let me get this straight. The prophet's father, two of his brothers, four Whitmers, and a guy who was married to a Whitmer. That is an unbelievably tight circle of trust.
It is. And it's not just that they're family. It's that they have this deeply shared cultural background. They all grew up in what a lot of historians call the magic worldview. If you're not familiar with that term, it just refers to a belief system common back then that relied on, finding spiritual guidance through physical things.
Meaning things like buried treasure or talking to God through special objects wasn't a strange idea to them.
Not at all. These were individuals who were already familiar with seer stones, divining rods, treasure digging, all of it. So that shared lens, that predisposition to believe in hidden spiritual objects is just crucial context when you're evaluating their claims.
It seems like a strange choice if you're trying to convince the whole world, right, to pick eight people who are already family and already part of this specific belief system.
Well, the official statement they signed tries really hard to sound concrete and physical to overcome that. Let's look at the actual words. They say Joseph Smith Jr. showed them plates that had the appearance of gold. They specifically say they did handle with our hands the pages that Smith had translated, and that they saw engravings of ancient work and of curious workmanship, and really importantly, they hefted the plates.
That language handle, saw, hefted, that's so deliberate. It's clearly meant to stop anyone from saying they only saw them with spiritual eyes. They were aiming for a completely unambiguous sensory experience.
They absolutely were. The document they signed was an affidavit that this was a purely physical, non-visionary thing.
And this insularity, this keeping it all in the family, is exactly what led to skepticism from outsiders, even back then. There's this fantastic quote from Mark Twain from his book, Roughing It. It's from 1871, so decades later, but it sums it up perfectly. Twain just kind of dismisses it, saying that based on the family ties, he could not feel more satisfied and at rest if the entire Whitmer family had testified.
He totally nailed the common sense problem, didn't he? Relying on a single interconnected group for your objective proof just, it undermines the whole thing for anyone outside that circle.
But even if we ignore critics like Twain, the internal records, the actual documents, raise their own questions about objectivity. Which brings us to our second section. All the puzzling specifics and contradictions.
The first puzzle is just the lack of detail from the church itself. The official history of the church is this massive 7-volume work, but it gives you almost no specific background on the eight witnesses. It just relies on that sign statement.
Hold on. If this was supposed to be the plain matter of fact moment, the hard evidence, why wouldn't you record every single detail? The date, the time, the exact location. Forgetting that seems almost intentional if you're trying to create proof that can be verified.
It does raise a lot of questions. We have no specific date or time. And another thing, all the signatures on that original statement, they're all in Oliver Cowdery's handwriting.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the men apparently verified it was what they wanted to say, but not having unique individual signatures is a huge red flag for historical evidence.
And the document itself was changed later on.
Yes. In 1837, the text was edited. It changed Joseph Smith from being the author and proprietor of this work to the translator of this work. These kinds of things, no specifics, one person's handwriting, later edits, they just create a cloud of ambiguity around this supposedly objective event.
But there's something even more damaging, isn't there? This letter from 1838 from Stephen Burnett, it quotes Martin Harris, one of the original three witnesses, talking about the eight.
This one is just explosive. Burnett quotes Harris saying that the eight witnesses never saw them and hesitated to sign that instrument for that reason, but were persuaded to do it. Just think about what that means. A key foundational witness, Martin Harris, is claiming the physical witnesses never actually saw the plates and that they had to be convinced or coerced into signing the document.
And Harris later apologized for saying it, basically for letting the secret out, but he never actually took back what he said. And that word persuaded, that's what gets me. If the plates are just sitting there physically on a table, why would anyone need persuasion? The object should speak for itself.
It implies there was a gap between what they were supposed to believe and what they were actually seeing, a gap that had to be closed by social pressure. That one letter just, it fundamentally compromises the whole idea of the eight witnesses being objective proof.
And then if you look at the credibility of the witnesses themselves, especially Hiram Page, you find an incident that makes you question their ability to tell truth from falsehood in the first place.
Yes. Hiram Page's Black Seer Stone incident in 1830. It's a fascinating look at prophetic control. Just a few months after testifying, he handled the plates. Page starts using his own seer stone, a black one, to get revelations for the church. And the really important part is that Oliver Cowdery and the whole Whitmer family, half the witnesses, they believed him. They thought his revelations were from God.
So you have a chosen witness, plus the other four Whitmer witnesses, all accepting revelations from a totally unauthorized source.
Exactly. And Joseph Smith has to step in fast to protect his position as the only one who gets revelations. He says the stone was consecrated for use by the devil. And he receives what's now Doctrine and Covenants, Section 28, which demands the stone be ground to powder and the revelations burned.
Which, okay, he had to do that to maintain his authority, but it completely shreds Hiram Page's credibility as a witness, doesn't it? If Page was so easily tricked by a satanic stone just months after seeing the sacred plates, what does that say about his judgment? It suggests he's highly suggestible.
And the logistical details of the viewing are inconsistent, too. John Whitmer, in a later testimony published in 1878, gives details that contradict other accounts.
What were those?
Well, for one, he said he saw the plates in Joseph Smith's house. That contradicts Lucy Mack Smith, who was adamant it happened in a grove of trees outside. And he also said they saw them in two separate groups of four, not all eight men together, like the official statement implies.
Seeing them in separate groups, that shatters the idea of one single unified objective event.
Mm-hmm.
It opens the door for different people to have different experiences.
Right. Now, Whitmer did stick to the physical story, saying he handled the leaves himself, but the contradictions in location and grouping just show how messy the memory of the so-called plain matter-of-fact event became over time.
Which brings us to Section 3, and this is where I think the biggest questions are.
Yeah.
The physical artifact itself. If this was a real physical object, the descriptions of it should be consistent. But our sources, they show a pretty shocking lack of agreement on what the plates were actually like.
The differences are just... they're profound. We're not talking about small variations here. When you compare what the Smiths, the Whitmers, and Martin Harris said, the dimensions are all over the map. Estimates for the size range from 6 by 8 inches all the way up to 9 by 10 inches.
And the thickness is even crazier.
It really is. It varied from just half an inch thick, that's Joseph Smith Sr.'s claim, all the way up to 4 to 6 inches thick. And the weight estimates are the same story, anywhere from 30 pounds up to 40 or even 60 pounds.
Wait a minute. If it was a 60-pound metal object, how do you explain the stories of Emma Smith or Martin Harris's daughter being able to lift it easily? The physics just don't work. A 60-pound block of gold or even tin would be incredibly dense and heavy.
This is where the whole thing starts to become an engineering impossibility based on their own descriptions. The plates were also described as being as thin as parchment, held together by three rings, and with edges you could ruffle, like rustling paper.
Ruffling like paper. That suggests a metal so thin it's basically foil.
Precisely. And that's the problem. Just basic physics and metallurgy. You can't engrave on both sides of a metal sheet that's thin enough to rustle, not without completely warping it, tearing it, or just having it fall apart under the pressure of the tools.
So just to be clear, it's like trying to carve your name with a chisel on both sides of a piece of heavy-duty aluminum foil without wrecking it. The claim that they were both physical gold plates and paper thin creates a structural contradiction.
It does. And as these physical descriptions came under more scrutiny over the years, a lot of the accounts seemed to just retreat back towards a spiritual explanation, which completely muddies the water of that original plain matter-of-fact claim.
You see that with John Whitmer, right?
Yeah.
In 1839, he says the plates were shown to him by supernatural power. That's a direct contradiction of the whole point of the eight witnesses.
It is. But maybe the strangest account of all is from Joseph Smith Sr., published after he died in 1870. He claims the plates were super thin and light, but then he adds these extraordinary new details that nobody else ever mentioned. He describes seeing Masonic implements and an alphabet key under the first plate, right next to the Urim and Thummim, the spectacles.
Masonic implements.
Yeah.
Where on earth did that come from? And why is he the only one who ever mentioned seeing that?
It's a really fascinating detail because it injects these very specific contemporary cultural symbols into a supposedly ancient artifact. The super detailed, totally uncorroborated story just. It splinters the collective memory of the event even further. It confirms that whatever these eight men saw, it wasn't a single, consistent, universally agreed upon physical thing.
So if the objective evidence is this messy family bias, contradictory descriptions, claims of coercion, a retreat to spiritual explanations, was our final takeaway here.
The paradox is just. It's undeniable. The eight witnesses were created to provide the solid, physical, non-visionary proof of the gold plates. But when you actually apply that plain matter-of-fact inspection to their testimony, it consistently fails to hold up as objective evidence.
I think our sources show pretty clearly that this whole thing really demonstrates Joseph Smith's remarkable ability to manage and guide the perception of his followers. By picking only people who were already deeply invested and part of that magic worldview, he basically ensured the testimony would stay within the realm of shared faith, not verifiable fact.
The fact that he only showed the plates to those who were already primed to believe, and that even those individuals gave contradictory accounts were accused of being persuaded, it just speaks volumes. It suggests the artifact's true nature was as a foundational myth, not a transparent historical object.
And that leads us to our final provocative thought for you to take away from this deep dive. If the whole purpose of the gold plates was to prove the Book of Mormon's truth to a skeptical world, why would God choose to show the physical artifact only to this tiny selective circle of family and friends who are already believers? Why create a situation that maximizes the need for faith while at the same time claiming to provide physical evidence? It just invites all these obvious questions of bias and collusion.
Yeah, think about the implications of choosing secrecy when objective proof was supposedly right there. What does that choice really suggest about the artifact's true role in starting a new religion?
The implications are profound. We encourage you to dig deeper into the sources yourself. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive. We'll see you next time.